Chapter 9. Nature of Concern. The old man was afraid of his nephew, physically and morally, and he began to regard Anne as a fellow sufferer under the same despot. After this sly and curious gaze at her, he withdrew his eye again, so that when she casually lifted her own there was nothing visible but his keen bluish profile as before. When the reading was about halfway through, the door behind them opened, and footsteps crossed the threshold. The farmer diminished perceptibly in his chair, and looked fearful, but pretended to be absorbed in the reading, and quite unconscious of an intruder. Anne felt the presence of the swashing Festus, and stopped her reading. "Please go on, Miss Anne," apostrophe he said. "I am not going to speak a word." ... He withdrew to the mantelpiece, and leaned against it at his ease. "Go on, do ye, Lady Anne," ... said Uncle Benjy, keeping down his tremblings by a great effort, to half their natural extent. Anne's voice became much lower now that there were two listeners, and her modesty shrank somewhat from exposing to Festus the appreciative modulations which an intelligent interest in the subject drew from her when unembarrassed. But she still went on, that he might not suppose her to be disconcerted, though the ensuing 10 minutes was one of disquietude. She knew that the bothering yeoman's eyes were traveling over her from his position behind, creeping over her shoulders, up to her head, and across her arms and hands. Old Benjy, on his part, knew the same thing, and after sundry endeavors to peep at his nephew from the corner of his eye, he could bear the situation no longer. "Do ye want to say anything to me, nephew?" ... He quaked. "No, uncle, thank ye," said Festus heartily. "I like to stay here, thinking of you, and looking at your back hair." ... The nervous old man writhed under this vivisection, and Anne read on, till, to the relief of both, the gallant fellow grew tired of his amusement, and went out of the room. Anne soon finished her paragraph and rose to go, determined never to come again, as long as Festus haunted the precincts. Her face grew warmer as she thought that he would be sure to waylay her on her journey home today. On this account, when she left the house, instead of going in the customary direction, she bolted round to the further side, through the bushes, along under the kitchen garden wall, and through a door leading into a rutted cart track, which had been a pleasant gravel drive when the fine old hall was in its prosperity. Once out of sight of the windows, she ran with all her might till he had quitted the park by a route directly opposite to that towards her home. Why she was so seriously bent upon doing this, she could hardly tell, but the instinct to run was irresistible. It was necessary now to clamber over the down to the left of the camp, and make a complete circuit round the latter infantry, cavalry, sutlers, and all descending to her house on the other side. This tremendous walk she performed at a rapid rate, never once turning her head, and avoiding every beaten track to keep clear of the knots of soldiers taking a walk. When she at last got down to the levels again, she paused to fetch breath, and murmured, "Why did I take so much trouble? He would not, after all, have hurt me." ... As she neared the mill, an erect figure with a blue body and white thighs descended before her from the down towards the village, and went past the mill to a stile beyond, over which she usually returned to her house. Here he lingered. On coming nearer, Anne discovered this person to be Trumpet Major Loveday, and not wishing to meet anybody just now, Anne passed quickly on, and entered the house by the garden door. "My dear Anne, what a time you have been gone!" ... said her mother. "Yes, I have been round by another road." ... "Why did you do that?" ... Anne looked thoughtful and reticent, for her reason was almost too silly a one to confess. "Well, I wanted to avoid a person who is very busy trying to meet me, that's all," ... she said. Her mother glanced out of the window. And there he is, I suppose, apostrophe she said, as John Loveday, tired of looking for Anne at the stile, passed the house on his way to his father's door. He could not help casting his eyes towards their window, and, seeing them, he smiled. Anne's reluctance to mention Festus was such that she did not correct her mother's error, and the dame went on. Well, you are quite right, my dear. Be friendly with him, but no more at present. I have heard of your other affair, and think it is a very wise choice. I am sure you have my best wishes in it, and I only hope it will come to a point. Apostrophe, apostrophe, what's that? Apostrophe, apostrophe, said the astonished Anne. You and Mr. Festus Derriman, dear. You need not mind me. I have known it for several days. Old Granny Seymour called here Saturday, and told me she saw him coming home with you across Park Close last week, when you went for the newspaper. So I thought I'd send you again today, and give you another chance. Apostrophe, apostrophe, then you didn't want the paper, and it was only for that. Apostrophe, apostrophe, he's a very fine young fellow. He looks a thorough woman's protector. Apostrophe, apostrophe, he may look it, apostrophe, said Anne. He has given up the freehold farm his father held at Pitstock, and lives in independence on what the land brings him. And when Farmer Derriman dies, he'll have all the old man's, for certain. He'll be worth £10,000, if a penny, in money, besides 16 horses, cart and hack, a 50-cow dairy, and at least 500 sheep. Apostrophe, apostrophe, Anne turned away, and instead of informing her mother that as he had been running like a doe, to escape the interesting air presumptive alluded to, merely said, Mother, I don't like this at all. Apostrophe, apostrophe, ix. Anne is kindly fetched by the trumpet major after this, and would on no account walk in the direction of the hall for fear of another encounter with young Derriman. In the course of a few days it was told in the village that the old farmer had actually gone for a week's holiday and change of air to the royal watering place near at hand, at the instance of his nephew Festus. This was a wonderful thing, to hear of Uncle Benji, who had not slept outside the walls of Oxwell Hall for many a long year before, and Anne well imagined what extraordinary pressure must have been put upon him to induce him to take such a step. She pictured his unhappiness at the bustling watering place, and hoped no harm would come to him. She spent much of her time indoors or in the garden, hearing little of the camp movements beyond the periodical ta-ta-ta-ta of the trumpeters sounding their various ingenious calls for watch setting, stables, feed, boot, and saddle, parade, and so on, which made her think how clever her friend the trumpet major must be, to teach his pupils to play those pretty little tunes so well. On the third morning after Uncle Benji's departure, she was disturbed as usual, while dressing, by the tramp of the troops down the slope to the mill pond, and during the now familiar stamping and splashing which followed there sounded upon the glass of the window a slight smack, which might have been caused by a whipper switch. She listened more particularly, and it was repeated. As John Loveday was the only dragoon likely to be aware that she slept in that particular apartment, she imagined the signal to come from him, though wondering that he should venture upon such a freak of familiarity. Wrapping herself up in a red cloak, she went to the window, gently drew up a corner of the curtain, and peeped out, as he had done many times before. Nobody who was not quite close beneath her window could see her face. But as it happened, somebody was close. The soldiers whose floundering Anne had heard were not Loveday's dragoons, but a troop of the York Hussars, quite oblivious of her existence. They had passed on out of the water, and instead of them there sat Festus Derriman alone on his horse, and in plain clothes, the water reaching up to the animal's belly, and Festus's heels elevated over the saddle, to keep them out of the stream, which threatened to wash rider and horse into the deep mill head just below. It was plainly he who had struck her lattice, for in a moment he looked up, and their eyes met. Festus laughed loudly, and slapped her window again. And just at that moment the dragoons began prancing down the slope in review order. She could not but wait a minute or two to see them pass. While doing so, she was suddenly led to draw back, drop the corner of the curtain, and blush privately in her room. As he had not only been seen by Festus Derriman, but by John Loveday, who, riding along with his trumpet slung up behind him, had looked over his shoulder at the phenomenon of Derriman beneath Anne's bedroom window, and seemed quite astounded at the sight. She was quite vexed at the conjunction of incidents, and went no more to the window till the dragoons had ridden far away, and as he had heard Festus's horse laboriously wade on to dry land. When she looked out, there was nobody left but Miller Loveday, who usually stood in the garden at this time of the morning, to say a word or two to the soldiers, of whom he already knew so many, and was in a fair way of knowing many more, from the liberality with which he handed round mugs of cheering liquor, whenever parties of them walked that way. In the afternoon of this day Anne walked to a christening party at a neighbor's in the adjoining parish of Springham, intending to walk home again before it got dark. But there was a slight fall of rain towards evening, and she was pressed by the people of the house to stay over the night. With some hesitation she accepted their hospitality, but at 10 o'clock, when they were thinking of going to bed, they were startled by a smart rap at the door, and on it being unbolted a man's form was seen in the shadows outside. "Is Miss Garland here?" the visitor inquired, at which Anne suspended her breath. "Yes," said Anne's entertainer, wearily. "Her mother is very anxious to know what's become of her. She promised to come home." To her great relief Anne recognized the voice as John Loveday's, and not Festus Derriman's. "Yes, I did, Mr. Loveday," said she, coming forward. "But it rained, and I thought my mother would guess where I was." Loveday said with diffidence, that it had not rained anything to speak of at the camp, or at the mill, so that her mother was rather alarmed. "And she asked you to come for me?" Anne inquired. This was a question which the trumpet major had been dreading during the whole of his walk thither. "Well, she didn't exactly ask me," he said rather lamely, but still in a manner, to show that Mrs. Garland had indirectly signified such to be her wish. In reality, Mrs. Garland had not addressed him at all on the subject, as he had merely spoken to his father on finding that her daughter did not return, and received an assurance from the miller that the precious girl was doubtless quite safe. John heard of this inquiry, and, having a pass that evening, resolved to relieve Mrs. Garland's mind on his own responsibility. Ever since his morning view of Festus under her window he had been on thorns of anxiety, and his thrilling hope now was that she would walk back with him. He shifted his foot nervously as he made the bold request. Anne felt at once that she would go. There was nobody in the world whose care she would more readily be under than the trumpet major's in a case like the present. He was their nearest neighbor's son, and as he had liked his single-minded ingenuousness from the first moment of his return home. When they had started on their walk, Anne said in a practical way, to show that there was no sentiment whatever in her acceptance of his company, "Mother was much alarmed about me, perhaps." "Yes, she was uneasy," he said, and then was compelled by conscience to make a clean breast of it. "I know she was uneasy, because my father said so. But I did not see her myself. The truth is, she doesn't know I am come." Anne now saw how the matter stood, but she was not offended with him. What woman could have been? They walked on in silence, the respectful trumpet major keeping a yard off on her right as precisely as if that measure had been fixed between them. As he had a great feeling of civility toward him this evening, and spoke again. "I often hear your trumpeters blowing the calls. They do it beautifully, I think." "Pretty fair. They might do better," said he, as one too well-mannered to make much of an accomplishment in which he had a hand. "And you taught them how to do it?" "Yes, I taught them. apostrophe apostrophe, it must require wonderful practice to get them into the way of beginning and finishing so exactly at one time. It is like one throat doing it all. How came you to be a trumpeter, Mr. Loveday? Apostrophe, well, I took to it naturally, when I was a little boy, apostrophe said he, betrayed into quite a gushing state by her delightful interest. I used to make trumpets of paper, elder sticks, eldritch stems, and even stinging nettle stalks, you know. Then father set me to keep the birds off that little barley ground of his, and gave me an old horn to frighten them with. I learned to blow that horn, so that you could hear me for miles and miles. Then he bought me a clarionet, and when I could play, that I borrowed a serpent, and I learned to play a tolerable bass. So when I listed I was picked out for training as trumpeter at once. Apostrophe apostrophe, of course you were. Apostrophe apostrophe, sometimes, however, I wish I had never joined the army. My father gave me a very fair education, and your father showed me how to draw horses on a slate, I mean. Yes, I ought to have done more than I have. Apostrophe apostrophe, what, did you know my father? Apostrophe apostrophe, she asked with new interest. Oh yes, 4 years. You were a little mite of a thing then, and you used to cry when we big boys looked at you, and made pig's eyes at you, which we did sometimes. Many and many a time have I stood by your poor father while he worked. Ah, you don't remember much about him, but I do. Apostrophe apostrophe, Anne remained thoughtful, and the moon broke from behind the clouds, lighting up the wet foliage with a twinkling brightness, and lending to each of the trumpet major's buttons and spurs a little ray of its own. They had come to Oxwell Park Gate, and he said, do you like going across, or round by the lane? Apostrophe apostrophe, we may as well go by the nearest road, apostrophe said Anne. They entered the park, following the half-obliterated drive till they came almost opposite the hall, when they entered a footpath leading onto the village. While hereabout they heard a shout, or chorus of exclamation, apparently from within the walls of the dark buildings near them. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.